thanks very much.
We'll find somewhere.
Sounds great, isn't it, on paper? Do my best. Apologise for the t-shirt first. My daughter was throwing all her old clothes out today. We were having a big throw, but she said, here, I have to have this. So my 20-year-old daughter's t-shirt. I'm not sure if it's me. I'll do my best. I'll look under the growl on the front. Alright, so, I kind of wanted to start with a poem about bankers and developers and stuff like, you know, to be really topical, but I haven't got any poems about bankers, really. But I got a short one, maybe just a short before we get into the pint.
Let's put it here.
So 746. For Dermot Desmond, 746 in the Forbes Rich List. It isn't fair. As Ryan Tuberty jokes on the radio, who wants to be 746 at anything? What's another billionaire? When to think, a touch more generous, a grand or two less needy, I'd be 747. And there's a number that rings. I'd be walking on air. I might have had wings. I did this one as I emcee the Kurt's clan in Galway, and I usually have to do a poem to begin it to get the whole thing going, and this is the one I did this year. I thought I'd do it again. This is my ode to clans and poetry competitions. Sorry, no poem, not one verse. The thing is, I was waiting for the budget to see if the situation would get worse. I mean, the whole thing caught me unawares. My lines have gone the same way as my shares. Face it, that those days are gone. Knocking off poems like there was no tomorrow. Now you can't get hold of the right words, beg, steal or borrow. My own stupidity. I put my trust in locations to liquidity. An amused called Beverly, who was working for the bank and a credit card company. Offering really big prizes, mostly offshore. I'm 120 lines. I should have known in the old days of austerity it was 40 lines and no more. So come on, who wouldn't be tempted? I wrecked my once tight sonnet for a rambling opus dopus, and now I have a structural deficit. I'm overexposed, when all was deftly transparent, now I'm the heir apparent to a pile of toxic tetrameters, yet it's hubble, bubble, rubble, boom to bust, all about economy. Okay, I'm feeling the pain, which should be a good start for a poet. Larkin, Plath, Wordsworth, for example, felt the pain. Wordsworth, but his bank was full of daffodils. You should always go for gold. I tell you it's a crime, no rhyme, subprime, subtext, I'm vexed. Upswing, growth, sure, talk about growth to an ingrowing toenail. Or Fianna Foyle. That's an eye rhyme, by the way. Okay, I'm sorry these lines are heavy. I'm feeling weighed down with a leady. Hard to be upbeat, just about to stay on my iambic feet. Repeat, I'm over the edge, I'm spent, every syllable is stressed. My bowels are loose, consequence of currying too much favour in the Galway tent. My consonants are hard ever since they took away the medical card. Once I thought my lines were hit till I met on board Snip. Now my villanelles have gone to hell. No one wants to invest. They gave me a rubber and a red pen. That's the bell. Give it a rest. Seems my metaphors are overextended. The lines are broken. I can't get them mended. I stopped sending them off. All the magazines say, see you later, regulator. The markets are just not responding. My poems no longer have purchase. Forget the pension. Oh, the tension. I'm moribund, staring at rejections from the International Poetry Fund. Now it's a never-ending long line leading to the door with no prospect of enjambment. So anyway, back to austerity, paring back. Can't even get a loan to build a haiku or knock off a two-liner. I'm down to the bone. No incentive. My verse was alive and alliterative, but now the equity is negative. My editor was an assault understanding. I hope for less bite, more bark, you know, soft copper, comma, maybe even a colon, but a full stop and a question mark. I pleased it to the Arts Council for a stimulus package. To make it fair, they sent me a brown paper bag full of air. My publisher won't get any gigs. I've been overlooked. They're saying my early development, all those launches and exotic places like Barn and Slope, was overcooked. So that's it. No poem. Every syllable's been cut. All I've left is the title. Which comes to think about it, doesn't count in the 40 lines. Yeah, the rest I can forget. Bye-bye, toxic debt. I found my loophole, my get-out clause, my haven, my shelter. Okay, this one's going to be a belter. It's called... bastards, bastards, bastards. If Keith, Roy, King, Joe Higgins and me were in charge, the world would be a better place. I could fit in a few choice epigrams, snips and quotes from previous plans, and may as well say hello to Mum and Dad and all my friends. Oh, I'm going to pay dividends. I've learnt my lesson. From now on, I'm cute. Everything's stripped back to my birthday suit, except the title. Here's another one coming. It's called The End is the Beginning of Another End, but in the meantime, drink the wine, sink the brew. Here we are in court. Thank you! My wild revolutionary political moment. I'm toning it down a bit now. Calm down a little.
Never.
I'm going to do a few, but my collection is called A Father's Day, so there's quite a lot of dad poems in here, so I've got a good dad poem there. As are my wonderful MC, thank you very much for that wonderful introduction. That I grew up in Bristol, and I was telling our friend over here, when I grew up in Bristol was a tip. There was nothing. It was just the docks. And the docks were sailors and the Salvation Army Cafe. And that's the only place to go. When you go to the Salvation Army Cafe and be harassed by Salvation Army, it's going to turn you into God and stuff. And cheap coffee. And that was it. There was nothing. Now it's gorgeous and trendy and beautiful and 24/7, culture. Anyway, when I was there, growing up, was not there. Anyway, this is about a song time I took my dad to see Neil Young. It's one of those nights where you're not sure if it's going to work out, but you try it anyway. Tonight's the night. I took Dad to see Neil Young. He wore his suit. Dad, that is. Neil Young wore a tie-dye shirt. 1975, I think. Bristol Colston Hall. Crazy Neil with crazy horse. And crazy me for bringing Dad. But he'd taken me to Cheddar Cave, Castle Coombe, and over on the ferry to South Wales. Again, Dad, not Neil Young. He mightn't have taken me anywhere yet. So I wanted to show him something. Even though his taste in music began and ended with Bing Crosby. Definitely Dad, not Neil Young, whose roots would be more, well, roots, country and rock and roll. And he was cross. Neil this time. My dad was surprisingly mellow, somewhat conspicuous. They started with a brand new song called Tonight's the Night, which the audience heckled, wanting more familiar tunes like Southern Man, Helpless and Cowgirl in the Sound. But Neil was having none of it. He gave us all a lecture, how this was about someone real close to him, a roadie who died from drugs. Bruce Barry was a working man. And he sang it again, only more aggressive, which pissed the audience off even more. I was hoping Dad was okay, not feeling out of place. But he seemed to be taking it all in, even nodding his silver head through the deranged 20-minute guitar solo. Eventually there was a compromise. The band won us over by doing all the old hits. And then for an encore to Tonight again. I never forget it. Afterwards, he brought me a takeaway. Dad's not Neil Young. Don't know what Neil and the band got up to. Maybe they went back to the hotel and talked about an old guy in the third from front row who had smiled all through the concert. Wondered what he was taking. Well, I enjoyed myself too. But Dad and Neil Young have gone well together. Bruce Barry was a working man. A couple of love poems. I'm learning a fiddle at the moment, and I've been learning a good strad since I kind of moved here and started on the mandolin, and now I'm kind of playing the fiddle. I'm really, really slow. But I'm in love. A fiddle. I just, it's erotic. And so this is about being a fiddle fan. Now, she says, let's begin getting to grips with the violin. We start with jigs, pick up the bow. Our tutor holds her fiddle up to show triangular meeting point. Left hand, neck, right hand, bow. Tip of bow, almost touching chin. We'll try not so. By the shores of Loch Gowna, otherwise known as Brian O'Lynn. What? Later that night, I'm counting the stars, hurling them in through parallel bars, three in a go, taking it slow. Left hand, neck, right hand, bow, chin. Outside the window, Orion's belt lighting up this heaven I'm in. By the shores of Loch Gowan, otherwise known as Brian O'Lynn.
Okay, I'll do this is a poem about a person.
I'm going to talk, but talking to both about it. Then. Do you ever have a crush on someone? Crush on someone you shouldn't have a crush on? Yeah? Okay, tell us about it. You didn't read your poem, so you can tell us about your crush. Do you want to tell us about your crush? Was it a sensible crush?
Well, it was someone, a friend of someone
I was doing it. Okay. Alright, yeah. Okay, right. Not here, are they? Not here. Okay. Actually, you can't have a sensible crush, can you? I mean, by definition, a crush is not a sensible thing. It's a painful thing. It's something you shouldn't do, really. You know, it's like you kind of sit on the yellow line for hours waiting for that traffic warden to come along to assist from your car. I mean, that's the kind of that's a crush. Anyway, this is a crush. This is about having a crush on the sort of the weather on the telly. Stormy weather. Hello? RTE, you gotta help, I'm in agony. It's your one that does the weather on TV. Occasionally. Yeah, I know, there are others, but that's what they are. Others. It's his policy of rotation. I've already checked the phone to the station. I said it's like the old Chelsea forward line. Leaving Zola on the bench had to be a sin. Even when he didn't score, you missed the grin. You know what I'm saying, Marion? Pat? Joe? I don't care what the weather is. I'll take anything. Hail, snow, but Jerry, not the pit. Bring on the rain, I won't complain. There's something in that smile which says, don't take this personally. I'll never forget, we at the Met are thinking of you always. Then that cute skip from side to side, those fixed eyes facing forward open wide, while all the time still pointing at the map. I get a shiver from pole to pole, my stomach turns to jelly. I feel like that chap who did the Mona Lisa, except he didn't have a telly. Look, there's one on now, complete imposter, pointing to some far-off Costa where it's surprise, 45 degrees in the shade, Belgrade, Adelaide, I don't care, I'd rather freeze. Anyway, I like to freeze. I really want to go abroad, I'd just be bored. Besides, I've paid my license fee. I want my sunshine here, with me.
Thanks. I thought you'd maybe give a few poems that are on the cheerful topic of mortality. Cheer us all up.
Hey!
Mortality fan.
Yeah.
This one, I'm wearing my daughter's t-shirt, so I do this poem for her. This is something I did a lot of when she was very small. She's 20 now, but we used to do this thing called playing boat. You ever done that playing boat? Where you you go to a stream or a river and you throw things in the river and you race and see who twig or wins. Yeah, have you done that? Yeah. Okay, alright, good, alright. It's like the Volvo Ocean Race, I mean, small. Playing boat for Kathy. Running for the river, she barely breaks her stride to pluck a yellow dandelion, but I take time to chew a broad tapering leaf, not too green. And here we come, her in front, approaching the first fall. Down, under, up she bobs, snags on a rock, but I career on into calmer water. But now she's wriggling and free, rotating, gathering momentum, until we're finally neck and neck, father and daughter, sailing up the Nile, the Amazon. A whirlpool. Now I'm in difficulties, taking in water, while she shoots clear. We watch, cheek to cheek, until her yellow head disappears beneath overhanging trees. Am I sad my boat's back? She asks. The rules are simple. If boats get stuck, we throw stones to dislodge ourselves, or run ahead removing obstacles. But what if one fails to make the start? Will our game not then be over? Come on, she coaxes, tidying my dark clouds, swiping another flower, falling under my chin. This time I speak a fresher, more robust leaf. Best of three, I say. Let's see that dandelion, then. And this next poem is called Coming Back, and it's kind of dedicated to Robert Frost. Any Frost fans? Any Robert Frost? You been to Robert Frost, are you? Cool. Not the person you had a crush on, is it? Okay, that'd be good. That'd be good to have a crush on Robert Frost. Has anyone ever heard Robert Frost read?
Yeah.
Yeah? He's got this amazing, like, you know, voice.
Yeah?
Yeah, he did. Yeah? And what did he say? What was it like?
Can
you do
it?
You can't do a rendition for it.
No, I can't do a rendition.
Okay, alright. Okay. Robert Frost has this big, like, voice. He does, something there is that doesn't love a wall! Kind of voice. I'm going to do it in his voice, because it's, you know, make a break from mine. And more fun. Coming back down, I was going up a mountain in Tipperary, and it was snowing, and on the way back down, there was a kid coming up with a toboggan, and attempted to home. I hold my toboggan up the hill, away to go on all so slow, but that of course is snow. I put my hands together and blow, I have the urge, the will, I must get to the top, then stop. But this is why I came so perilously high, to brush these clouds in communion, greet the rising sun, then know the thrill of going down. But here I am the clown, the journey up took far too long, and now the run is past and gone. And that, of course, is snow. I know. I know! About my dad, and although my mom comes into it as well. So you know, sometimes you do. It's fun that thing earlier, writing poems in 5 words. Just, you know, sometimes just have an idea and just work with it. And sometimes I like the idea of taking an object and just writing about an object, but then like bringing a person in related to that object. You know, and so this is about my dad. It's called the chair. It's like my dad was part of that generation where like old dads had their chair. You know, you never sat in dad's chair, you know that. Yeah. The chair. A quiet man, unobtrusive, once tucked in he became invisible. And though we might occasionally sink into the worn upholstery, it was only for my father the chair agreed to work its special charm, wrapping him in snug arms, offering safe harbour. My mother, in contrast, was everywhere, perpetual motion like a fish. Your supper's on the table. I think I'll eat it on my lap, he replied, heading for his retreat. Sundays, the doldrums, metallic skies of dull chrome. The family dinner over, I'd sneak out, leaving him in his usual place. Herschel wants to be calm, sprawled on the settee like Eartha Kitt, watching the box, stoked on tedium. When the cat got in and peed all over Dad's chair, my mother took the excuse to have the things thrown out. That evening, gathered like porpoises or sharks around a raft, we witnessed a rare moment, akin to a death or the sighting of land. When he seemed for one totally visible, hesitating, as if expecting the world to right itself, before paddling sideways to the bare rock where my mother lay like a silent in her best Carmen curls. Wait. There's a kind of a big, I don't know, there's a website called Three Monkeys, and there's a whole debate going on at the moment about politics and poems, whether poems should be political, and whether if you're a poet, you should be a political poet, or have a political life, and it's very interesting. You want to check it out. People like Dave Lord and William Wong, so I thought I'd be the political poem. It's funny writing poems that are political. But this poem is also, I don't think it's just about terrorism, it's about fear, and it's about, in a way it's kind of about writing. But I was in London years ago, it was at the Museum of Modern Art, and they had a magazine in the bookshop, and it was a magazine. In the magazine they had poems written by Guantanamo detainees, and they'd actually been published in this magazine. I was kind of amazed to see they'd actually published poems, some of these people. And when I read on to find out that they were heavily censored in a particular kind of way. and a song called Keeping Terrorists at Bay. The Guantanamo inmates are writing poems. Why not? Guests also enjoy cricket, baseball, and Irish dancing. Putting it all down with sharpened pencils, making marks you can see on paper that doesn't lie. Despite all the free time, the scribbling is frenzied. Some detainees compose automatically, even in sleep. One epic alone is 1,000 stanzas, and the writer knows them by heart. They have never left the heart. A few shorter verses have even been published. There are boundaries to this generous dispensation. Prisoners are not allowed to communicate. The poem must not carry a message intended for other ears. This is too wishy-washy. Let us make it even clearer. A poem cannot be aimed at an identifiable target. One opus has been intercepted and destroyed because it addressed the writer's mother, beginning, "Dear Mother." Remember, these people are devious. They do not know the ropes or understand restraints. Deceptive ramblings may contain hidden devices guiding the reader towards subversive meaning. You have to know the code to see between the lines. It's a cultural thing, and the hard-pressed authorities employ special sensors trained to spot clues. Even here you cannot be too careful. Who can tell? Perhaps some in secret are poets themselves. It's hard not to be swayed by the power of words. As a precaution, our line detectors and semantic nitpickers are relieved from duty at regular intervals to avoid battle fatigue, the possibility of seduction. The prisoners are not as innocent as they claim. Believe us, we've had to discover the hard way. Some poems are heat-seeking and know their purpose. Others step up, clothed in a bland conformity, so you drop your guard and wave them through, only to find they carry a hidden payload. There is an imperceptible pull, a nanosecond when you are neither hot nor cold, north, south, east, or west, alive or dead, before all becomes crystal clear, as the words literally explode in your face, or worse still, inside your head. I don't know, politics, maybe personal politics, just for what, you know, my collection is about fathers and being a father, but it's also kind of a lot something about, I don't know, gender and men and women and all that and there's this poem, Men Missing, is quite, this, again, I've dedicated this to Lorca. You know, Lorca means like during the Spanish Civil War, and he, there's a play by Lorca called Blood Wedding. Do you know it? You familiar with it? It's an amazing story where it starts off with this old woman and the son, and the son's going to get married, and but it's full of this terrible kind of feeling that something's going to go wrong, and the mother is supposed to be knitting. She talks to the son, and because the woman he's going to marry had a previous lover, and this guy's still there, hovering out there, a threat. And sure enough, what happens is they're just about to get married, and the previous lover appears. And the bride and the bride-to-be and the lover are off on horse and they're gone, pursued by the groom and his family. And it ends up in a terrible knife fight, and everyone's killed, you know. And it's kind of very sad, tragic kind of thing, anyway. But in the thing about Lorca was he was very, didn't work within a kind of surreal, non-naturalistic kind of idea. And the idea is that during this story, the guy who's being pursued is running through the forest, and he meets an old woman in the forest, and she opens up her cape, and you hear this violin, and then all these girls run on stage with red wool, balls of red wool, and they run up and down the stage with this red wool, and so the whole stage is full of red wool, and then you know he's been killed, and there's been a knife fight, and it's all over, and I just love that kind of, you know, that way of doing it. Men knitting. The men are hard at it, knitting hats, scarves and gloves for a blood wedding. Prolonged engagement, sitting in hired rooms, push and shove. The men are hard at it, knitting the same pattern, no quitting. Inexorably the cord rises above for a blood wedding to end all season, as hard-hitting comrades line up like coloured doves. The men are hard at it, knitting by firesides and bonfires, spitting hot confetti, making the most of a blood wedding, while up the road they're fitting fresh coils of razor wool with love. Blood wedding. The men are hard at it. missing. There's all kind of this, actually, I was going to say there's a string, but this is a terrible poem. There's three poems in a row there. They're kind of connected by a thread, string, that's missing, and then there's one called super strings, and then there's this one called drawing a line, and there's kind of this sort of... This is, I don't know if there's sort of guidance here, okay? do you know that there was a survey done, and what the domestic chore that men hate the most, do you know what it is?
Ironing?
Yeah. That might be fourth or fifth, or I don't know, it didn't come top anyway. But good, yeah. What?
Junior Tyler.
Yeah, that's a good one, yeah. No, it wasn't that. No, any other favourite ones? Any other kind of favourite gripes?
No,
that's a good one, yeah, that's pretty good. No, anyway, it was hanging out the washing.
Okay,
yeah, well, okay, you're...
A woman.
You're a new man. A hero. Anyway, also just connected to this, Prime Minister Berlusconi of Italy once ordered, before an EU conference, the local washing lines to be taken down because they were covered in women's underwear. So it would be offensive, distasteful to the people coming to the conference. Drawing a line. Contention up, or so it seems, down at the machine, one-on-one at the very heart of the domestic scrum, hunky on our hunkers, a packet of bowls held up to say we won the cup. And if we choose to play it rough, isn't there that bullfight ad where the guy goes mad, rolls in the mud to save his jeans before his blood? So why not parade it? Surely a row of sun-dried denims hanging free, raw, spicy, Tex-Mex, sizzling, exotic scent. No messing with this high plains rolling drifter. But no. They have to draw the line somewhere. For now we come to the delicate things in life, those belonging to the girlfriend or the wife. Perhaps to be caught out there, broad daylight, pegs between the teeth, bras, knickers waving in the breeze, we feel uneasy. As if another man sizing by in disbelief might see how we've been trapped and tamed, ashamed, flying the flags of our intimacy, her territory, hung out to dry, lonesome cowboy holding a fistful of clothesline. But strangely enough, she likes to linger, holding up our wife's front boxer's jocks, declaring loud and clear, my husband's socks, brazen as the gold ring on her finger. You have to draw a line somewhere. I do maybe two, three. One very short one and one longish one. And okay, is that right? Yeah, I don't know. I'm trying to find it. I went to a church a while ago. There was a guy came up and he did a poetry workshop, and we all wrote these poems like he did earlier, and then he cut them to pieces, you know, that thing where you just pair it back to you, and it was something very sort of small. So I ended up with a poem with three words. It started to have five verses, first of all, and then ended with three words. He wouldn't like this, he wrote along with the narrative thing. So and I called it Sad. It was bird, cat, feathers. Okay. Five verses before I did that, you know, that's a lot of work. Okay, last one. This is the Father's Day begins, it's kind of to do with fathers and fathers and stuff like that, but it starts off with me in Eastern Galway, they were there and looking for a Father's Day card, and it kind of goes off on a Dante-esque kind of weird nightmare journey from there. And in the second half of the book, I kind of return to Ethan to have another go at buying a card, having failed the first time. So this is called Father's Day Reprieve. The next time I'm in Ethan, I hung around downstairs for a while, browsing through Dante's Inferno, so I feel more buoyed and cheerful, up and ready for it, ascend the escalator, relax. As in the Paradiso, a smile on my face. I can tell because today I stand still and allow the moving metal to carry me. I get to the top and bump into the back of another man who has stopped dead. He seems afraid to get off and is backpedaling as fast as he can. It's like a moonwalk routine and I have to do it too. I feel a hand on my hip and now there's a line of us in a conga all moon dancing. one small step, the man said, but this one is huge. We stretch out into the street. Passers-by think it's a parade, practicing for Paddy's Day. But no, this is for Father's Day. We have all come to pay our tributes and respects. Now the security guard is taking the man at the front in his arms, lifting him to safety, bearing him like a lover, a hug to die for. Then it's a rush to buy our card. One fellow is ancient. He looks like Rip Van Winkle. White beard dragging on the floor. Surely your father can't be still alive, I say. He tells me the card is for himself. He buys several every year, one from each of his children. Are they all dead, I ask? To me, he replies. I say nothing. We're all searching for our fathers, reaching for the right word, an appropriate image, their pictures of golf, football, and hoping for a lawnmower, amazed to find one. But the message inside puts me off, too religious. After all, it's my own father I'm looking for. I try to visualize a wheelbarrow, a red one. I'm almost settling for an empty chair, when I spot something. The message says, well done, you've passed your test. And I realize I've wandered into another section, and suddenly feel dizzy, sensing one more false move I could be falling through hoops. And some McNeese's soap suds, or take a wrong turn, and end up like Dante in a nightmare parallel world, where the cards read, hard luck you failed, miserable birthday, Christmas condolences, commiserations on your wedding. I realize I'm being observed. There's a man eyeing me from behind the stationery. It isn't the security guard, because he's still giving bear hugs to needy fathers stepping off the escalator. I'm thinking that Eastland should give him a pay rise at least. No, this man looks like a Cold War spy, tough and uncompromising. I notice that he has an umbrella with a sharp point. I know why he's here. He's here to see, he's sent by my father to see if I'm buying him a car. I return my attention to the greeting. Perhaps I will choose a funny one after all. Sorry, Dad, forgot to buy you a car. Dad rhymes with sad, mad, glad, cad, bad, had. Knock, knock, who's there? Dad, who? But now, as if a hooter has sounded, we grab our cars, descend the stairs en masse. There's no down escalator in Eastern Scorn. We will take you up, but you have to bring yourself down. A strange subliminal message. And there is the security guard, back in his spot by the door, flexing his lips and eyebrows as if nothing has happened, staring straight ahead like men do at urinal. I imagine it's part of the training. And I know that everything is back to normal. The next person getting a bear hug will be some poor soul who was in a moment of weakness, failed to pay for his copy of New Scientist, DIY Weekly, or Men's Health. Outside the boxers are playing, the rain is falling, I feel a sudden urge to shake hands with a man coming towards me, a complete stranger. I'm thinking, why not? I will offer my hand before we end up killing each other. I'll finish with this on a kind of optimistic note. You know, I don't know, something, maybe poems, you know, they used to be safe as houses, money in the bank, like those great stalwarts of security and solidity are gone, you know, like, you know, bubbles. And maybe, you know, you can trust a poem or hang on to a poem, maybe a poem could be as solid, as secure and as hopeful and as reliable as anything now. Wasting away. We hope that some things cannot be erased. The Buddhist sees each sorry soul return. The most of it will have to go to waste. Hooked on progress, forever making haste, we gobble up, incinerate, and burn, believing some things cannot be erased. And for fear we may become debased, we cultivate improvement, seek to learn. The most of it will have to go to waste. But whether we're the chaser or the chased, much like a coin, depending on the turn, hoping that some things cannot be erased, we look back at those footprints, barely paint, lay lines of meaning wistfully discerned. The most of it will have to go to waste. Thinking then of this life, but for the taste of things to come, beyond our current concern, accepting we will one day be erased, we hope and pray that something never goes to waste. Thanks very much.